This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
This afternoon to Professor Rachel Webster from the University of Melbourne, Professor of Astrophysics there, has just finished, I believe, serving as Chair of the National Astronomy Committee, Council, whatever it's called, I can never remember exactly. Rachel has a long background in this area. I think the only time I met her previously was probably when I was giving a talk at the University of Melbourne, I think in 1994, and I think you'd just come back from Rice University, is that right?
Toronto.
She must have been in Toronto because she said Toronto in the way in which the locals do. Also been very active in promoting the physical sciences for female students, which I think is a fundamentally important thing. And actually, it's amazing how many female students do get attracted into the sciences by astronomy. Astronomy is a fantastic thing. Lots of people very, very interested in it, obvious from the audience here. And so without further ado, because you want to listen to her, not to me, I'll hand over to Rachel Webster to talk about new directions in astronomy.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Duncan. So I'm going to speak today. I'm going to talk a little bit about how I came to be an astronomer. I'm going to talk a little bit about astronomy and then just make some broader comments about, well, indeed, women in astronomy and other things. So for the past 30 years, I've had the privilege of working in astrophysics and cosmology. But my career in this area has been at once a realisation of a passion, but also perhaps an accident. In my late teens, I heard that an American cousin of mine had been selected to attend an international school on inner and outer space at the University of Sydney. So I wrote to Professor Harry Messel, as you do when you're 16 and don't know any better, and asked if I could go too. And that was my first introduction to cosmology. To say that it blew my mind was an understatement. So perhaps a decade later, when I was reorganising the office accommodation in the Victorian Public Service, I realised that I didn't want to reach 40 and end up saying, oh my God, I always wanted to be a cosmologist and look, I got stuck in the public service. So I applied to a bunch of UK universities and surprisingly, in retrospect, was accepted to a couple, but I really wanted to go to Cambridge, having read that there was a really fine cosmologist there. Martin Rees wrote to me and said he would be interested in having me as a student, but first of all, I had to establish that I could do physics, and then Cambridge could consider my application. So I completed a master's and gained a place at Cambridge, and indeed ended up with Martin Rees as my supervisor. As far as I was concerned, I was following my passion. But for reasons that are not completely clear to me now, I considered that my other colleagues who had reached had places at Cambridge by much more normal academic routes had a greater entitlement than I did. And I actually remember using the term dilettante to describe myself. I was there to follow a great passion. But I've got quite a different perspective now. I see colleagues around me jockeying for positions of prestige, for honours and for any recognition that will increase the metrics which measure a successful scientific life. But for me, it's still the passion to understand a vast universe out there which is of paramount importance. So today what I want to do is to discuss two ideas which now dominate our ideas in cosmology. Those are what is the nature of the universe and what is life. To answer these questions, we need to be able to apply the scientific method to understand observations of objects which are on the other side of the universe. And I'm going to start by talking about the nature of the universe. For about 50 years, we've understood the basic stuff that we're made from. We call these baryons, and these were initially made in something that we call the Big Bang. Now, the Big Bang has absolutely nothing to do with an explosion. It's quite a misnomer in that way, but simply refers to the earliest times in the universe. At those times, hydrogen and helium, the first two elements in the periodic table, were made, and not much else. And so where did the elements that are so crucial to life come from? Well, the only place to manufacture those heavier elements is in the death throes of a very, very massive star, which in its last few moments goes through a cycle of collapsing and heating up, and it ends with a very massive explosion which actually generates oxygen, iron, carbon, and all the elements that we know of as constituents for life. And in that explosion, those elements are spewed out into space, and they then form the gas clouds out of which the next generation of stars is made. So in a very, very real sense, we are made from stardust. The actual atoms in your bodies and in mine were manufactured in a supernova explosion which occurred before our solar system was made. Quite extraordinary if you think about it. But the magic of the universe doesn't end there. Astronomers have a very simple technique to weigh objects on the other side of the universe. Obviously, it's quite difficult to go out there with a set of scales and figure out what a galaxy weighs. But what we do is we assume that the objects that we see are in equilibrium. And by equilibrium, we simply mean that they're going to sit there for quite a long time and remain in the state that they're in. It doesn't mean that they're stationary, but they'll just remain the way they are for perhaps billions of years. If we see a concentration of stars or of galaxies that are remaining constant like this, then what it tells us is that the gravity which is holding that object together must be perfectly balanced by the motions of the objects wanting to hold it up. So we have an equilibrium situation. And the motions, of course, would drive the body apart, and so the gravity holds it together. Now, we can measure quite readily with our large telescopes, we can measure the motions of the objects, whether they're stars or galaxies. And so what that allows us then to do is to calculate how much gravity is needed to hold the object together. And when we do that, we can work out what the mass of the object is, because that is just a measure of the gravity. So when we do this, we discover that there must be about five times as much matter in these objects as the matter that we can see. And the evidence for this additional matter is really very, very strong now. It's probably completely, without argument, I would say. And so we've given a name to this matter that we can't see. We call it dark matter because we literally can't see it. So our colleagues, the particle physicists, are hunting for this stuff in their experiments at CERN using the Large Hadron Collider. This is the very big accelerator which is under parts of France and Switzerland near Geneva, and they accelerate charged particles to very, very high velocities and crash them together to see if they can in fact form these dark matter particles that we know must exist. The theoreticians have quite a few ideas of where these particles might fit in to their models for the structure of matter, but as yet nobody has actually detected one of these dark matter particles, so we don't actually have a name, if you like, or a proper definition of exactly what this dark matter is. But astronomers have been able to tell the physicists that it definitely exists. This story has really only solidified in the last 15 years or so, and it seems strange enough. But it's actually not the end of the strange story of cosmology as we understand it today. Our understanding of the universe has recently taken a new and totally unexpected direction. There's another constituent in the universe, and this one is not like baryonic matter, which we know and love, or dark matter, which has at least been around for a while and we think we can describe. Both of these sorts of matter behave quite reasonably, and they have mass, and they gravitationally attract, so we can describe their behaviour in a quite straightforward way. But the new stuff behaves very differently. It actually acts to cause the universe to expand on the very larger scales. It acts in the opposite way to gravity. We're used to the idea that the universe is expanding, although I think this is quite a challenging idea for somebody who hasn't necessarily worked in cosmology for a while. But as a cosmologist, you get quite used to the idea that the universe is actually expanding. But until now, we've all believed that that expansion has been slowing down with time as the gravitational force of the matter in the universe actually acts to cause a deceleration. So we've got an expanding universe, but it's actually slowing down. And the question has always been whether or not it would slow down enough to stop and turn around and collapse again, or whether the expansion was stronger and it would in fact expand forever. It turns out that both of those scenarios are quite wrong. The universe isn't going to do either of those things, because there's this new component in the universe, this new stuff, which is actually increasing the rate of expansion. So it's expanding and then it's increasing, and that rate of expansion is actually accelerating. So we do know what sort of universe we live in. It's one where the expansion is accelerating. It's driven by stuff that is really quite foreign to us in any way that we've understood up until now. We've coined a term, of course, to describe this stuff. It's called dark energy. But to say that we have much deeper understanding than that would be stretching a point, I think. So we can write down a few simple equations to describe the dark energy, but at this stage, as I say, we understand very little else about it. So I think it should come as no surprise that the universe still has major new challenges to offer us. As physical scientists, we've concentrated on trying to describe the physical universe, even suggesting that we might be able to develop a theory of everything. Yet we've completely ignored the fact that life, intelligence, consciousness, and so on all must exist in our universe, and must in some sense be a consequence of the nature and structure of the universe that we live in. This last decade has seen the development of a major new area called astrobiology, or the search for life amongst the stars. It's still in its infancy, however the roadmap for this search is starting to bear fruit. We are starting to ask the right questions and even to answer some of them. We found our first planet outside our solar system in 1995, so that's just 14 years ago. And at last count, we knew of over 350 planets outside our solar system. They're coming in at the moment at the rate of a few a week, so quite rapidly. Most of the planets we're finding are quite in solar systems that are quite different from our own. So this has been our first surprise, if you like. But that may still just be what we call a selection effect. It may just be a result of the sort of observations that we've been able to make up until now. What we're finding are lots of planets like Jupiter, lots of Jupiter-like planets, but the thing that has been surprising is that a lot of them are sitting closer to their star than Mercury. Okay, so really, really quite close in. We call these hot Jupiters. We've found a few planets with masses as low as Earth, but those planets are quite difficult to detect, and our techniques for doing that are just starting to bear fruit. And what we're now starting to do is to look for planets which might have liquid water, because generally we expect that if you want to find life, then liquid water or something that operates in a very similar way to liquid water will be necessary to protect life in its early stages of evolution. So astronomers are working with biologists to understand what might constitute a signature for life as we look at a planet not halfway across the universe, but somewhere out there in our galaxy. And in that process, of course, we're also starting, along with the biologists who have been doing this for much longer, to think about what constitutes a definition of life. What is life, and what would we expect to detect? I believe that finding life somewhere other than on Earth would constitute a radical shift in our understanding of who we are in the universe, comparable to the shift in understanding developed when Copernicus described the solar system, a solar system where Earth was not at the centre of our universe, but simply one of a number of planets orbiting around a very ordinary star, our Sun. So finally, what I would like to comment on is what it means to be a woman in astronomy. How do women do science, and how do they fare as members of the scientific community? The following comments reflect the things that I've observed and understood over the past 30 years or so working as an astronomer. Astronomy is perhaps one of the softest of the hard sciences and has allowed for some collective introspection from a group of active women researchers who have risen through the ranks internationally. So the following comments reflect not only experience in astronomy, but probably more broadly as well, I think. So the first thing that I want to comment on is that I think women see a more complex web or network, not only in the prosecution of their scientific endeavours, but also in their personal relationships with the others who are undertaking study with them. For the most part, they don't work in isolation, but strive to be part of a community of scholars. The second comment I would make is that in science, if you're broadly focused, it's much harder to scale extraordinary heights in some narrow area. It's a very competitive arena, and the accolades go to those who can push to the greatest heights, spend the longest hours, travel at the drop of a hat, move to a new position every few years, and so on. There are actually few women amongst us who are prepared to forego the joys of family life, support of a community, and the more holistic lifestyle simply to pursue a scientific career. Third point is that I think women are certainly no less intellectually able than their male counterparts, though perhaps they may have more choices from being more broadly talented. Provocatively, I'll say that there is now some evidence that women who are rather good at maths and science often excel in the humanities as well, and that, of course, offers them a broader choice of career. So in summary, I would say that the proclivities and choices of women have mitigated against them making science a career. Of course, there are additional issues, such as the absence of mentoring, etc., which can affect a woman's career. But I think those broad issues that I mentioned first are probably the dominant ones. So let me sort of draw the comments that I wanted to make to a conclusion. Science has taught us how to understand the stars, but the universe is actually turning out to be a much more complex and interesting place than we expected. It is unclear that our journey to understand it has an end point. It may, in fact, be a journey without an end point. And the practice of scientific endeavour has been quite gendered, I think, over the last century or so. And indeed, the last few comments I want to make are about our broader management of our planet, which is, after all, just a small and rather insignificant part of the universe. And I believe our management of our planet has actually has left us in a rather untenable and unsustainable position. This is something that we would now term climate change. And what we need is a much more holistic approach to not only to our science, but to its role in the wider community. We have the opportunity to take lessons from understanding the stars and the planets, understanding what happens in the atmospheres of planets in our own solar system, and apply that to our own backyard. And I believe that climate change is going to force us to reconsider how we live. The outcome cannot be a scientifically based society which exploits its physical and human resources to provide great material comfort for a few. Rather, we need to develop a society which will provide a comfortable existence for all, and as a bonus, free all of us to explore intellectual, artistic, emotional, philosophical, and other what I call energy-free pursuits, which can only enhance our collective and individual well-being. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Rachel. We've got plenty of time for questions, which is a great thing. Usually we're shorter time for questions. Now, there's a roving mic over here, which I'd like you to just give the lady a chance to get to you so everybody else can hear your question. Please, sir.
Two questions. Firstly, a technical one. The Earth, as I understand it, is mainly iron and nickel, a big lump, and the oxygen and water and all that sort of stuff is part of the cloud, the dust that is collected from the stars. Did the Earth pop out of one of these explosions as a whole lump, and then all the other bits that got on it come later? That's the first question. And the second question is more on the career aspect that you were talking about. Does modern technology allow you to get out of this geographical trap you seem to be in about having to, chase the radio telescopes or something in your career?
Okay. Let me answer the first question about the formation of the solar system first of all. So the idea we have for the evolution of the solar system is that we start with just a gas cloud, which wouldn't necessarily be very dense, might be quite large, and then it starts to collapse under gravity, so it contracts. It might have a little bit of rotation initially, but of course, just like an ice skater, as it contracts, it spins up until it's rotating quite quickly. The stuff at the centre condenses to form the sun, and around the sun is a disk of material which still has that, what we call, would still have the same concentration of elements as the sun. So it would still be, 99% hydrogen, a bit of helium, and a few of the heavier elements. Then, as time progresses in that disk, little bits of dust and stuff start sticking together, so you start to form snowballs in the disk. And then when the sun turns on, it actually blows away all of the light elements, like hydrogen and helium, in the inner part of the solar system, and you're left with the heavier elements, like the iron and nickel and so on that you spoke of. And in the outer part of the solar system, where it's cooler and not so warm, you still have, quite a lot of hydrogen, helium and so on. So what you end up with, and this is in the case of our own solar system, it may be a different story when we start to learn about some of the others, but in the inner part we have rocky planets, so that's the four rocky planets that we know and love, and then as you go further out, where the influence of the sun has been much less, we get the gas giants, which still have all their hydrogen and helium, as well as probably the same concentrations of, iron and nickel and so on. So, roughly, that's the sort of process. Okay. So that's the first question.
Can I just add something to that? You started off by saying it was a cloud of gas. Of course, it's gas and dust, and I think the gentleman may have been a little bit confused in thinking that about the dust, of course, is the nickel and iron and
yes.
so on,
okay? Yeah.
Which has been spawned by supernova explosions in the past. So the reason that we're mostly rocky and nickel and iron and so, is that a lot of the rest of the stuff, the hydrogen and helium, has been lost from the Earth. So it isn't the Earth was there originally and then stuff has come in. Is that okay?
It's been an agglomeration process, yep. And Duncan's perfectly right. I say gas. Gas means, iron as well, but it's gas and dust is a better
way. To astronomers, there's only hydrogen, helium and metals in the universe. Metals means something different to what it means to a chemist.
Okay, the second question is a very interesting one, actually. In the past, as astronomers, we went and did our own observations. I would go to Coonabarra Brown, use the Anglo-Australian Telescope or Parkes or wherever. But that is actually changing quite markedly now. I don't go and use the Hubble Space Telescope. What happens is it's run by computers, and the data gets delivered to my computer at the University of Melbourne. Australia owns a share of the Gemini telescopes, one of which is in Hawaii and one of which is in Chile, and most of the observations there, the data is taken by somebody else and it's delivered to my computer at the University of Melbourne. So I don't actually have to travel to do the observing. However, what you still do have to do, because you're part of an international community of scholars, if you were to try and stay at the University of Melbourne all your academic life, well, in fact, you probably couldn't do it, okay? And the reason is that you wouldn't have the links and the collaborations and everything else that you need for a broad scientific life. So in fact, if you train in one location, the rules of the game largely are you must go somewhere very, very different for your first postdoc, somewhere very, very different again for your second one, and so on. And so you get this large mix of within the international community of where people are at any one time.
Lady over there with the microphone, please.
Yes, thank you. Endersby, who was of Monash, put out a book, Journey of Discovery. I got hold of it in the library too. It was fascinating. And in it, he believes that the Earth itself is expanding. Do we know anything further on that? And secondly, who was the person who discovered dark energy?
Okay. So in answer to your first question, I've in fact, I've mostly read Lance Enderby's book. And for the life of me, I couldn't figure out what the physics of an expanding Earth would be. So I haven't actually had detailed discussions with him, but I don't think it works, is the short answer. Dark energy, interestingly, the attribution for the discovery of dark energy to two teams of astronomers who were measuring very distant supernovae in the universe, and they were using this to measure the geometry of the universe. One team was led by a guy called Perlmutter, who is an American, and the second team is actually led by an Australian called Brian Schmidt, who's at ANU. And so all the accolades at the moment are going to those two teams for the discovery of dark energy.
Can you tell us what the status is for the 1 square kilometre radio telescope?
Yes, I can. So let me, for those of you in the audience who may not be familiar with the square kilometre array, which we usually call the SKA in this horrible way of using acronyms the whole time, but the idea is to build a radio telescope that has a square kilometre of collecting area, which is a hell of a lot. And that's sort of the easy bit to say. The hard bit to say is to build it for $1 billion, which I still don't know if we're going to be able to do it cheaply enough to actually make it feasible. But an important aspect of this is that the square kilometre of collecting area is not all going to be in one place. The core of the telescope, if it's located in Australia, will be at Bulardi, a place in Western Australia about 10 hours northeast of Perth. But it's an interferometer, right, which means that the collecting area will be distributed over large areas. So, in fact, there'll be bits of that telescope in South Australia, in Victoria, New South Wales, New Zealand, and so on. You can see the politics of this already, I'm sure. But anyway, the idea is to have what we call baselines, which are separations between the elements that are about 3,000 kilometres in two directions. So it'll cover the whole of Australia. Now, this idea has been bought by the international scientific community, so the Square Kilometre Array will be an international telescope with everybody buying into it, basically. The process, so they went through a process to establish where it might be built about 3 years ago, and two places came out on top. So they down-selected down to two places. One was Australia, the Bulardi site that I've mentioned, and the second place is South Africa. So at the moment, Australia is in competition with South Africa for the right to physically host the Square Kilometre Array. Now, of course, this is a pretty big deal internationally, and it'll be about $1 billion of investment, although these telescopes usually end up costing two or three times what you set out to, what you say at the onset. But the selection between Australia and South Africa at the moment is supposed to occur in 2012, but most of us wouldn't be surprised if that date slipped a little bit. In the meantime, what we're trying to do in Australia is to build our credentials to be the host for this telescope, and that has involved buying the cattle station, so CSIRO has bought the cattle station, setting up legal requirements about radio quietness around the area, which are quite strict. There's no other place on Earth that has requirements like this. I should say the area around the site, around Bulardi, an area the size of the Netherlands, we always like to compare it with what somebody understands, has about 100 people living in it. There are no gazetted towns in this area. And so this makes it a very, very competitive site for a telescope of this nature, because every time you turn on your mobile phone, start your car, turn on your microwave, you send out radio emission that can stuff up the observations, the very sensitive observations that we want to make. So that's currently where it sits. It will be a very political process in the end.
Thanks, Rachel. I know there's a question at the back of the microphone. Then the gentleman here with the blue sweater and the scarf, and then there was a question down the front.
I wonder if you can update my concepts. I've read that space, and I'm a bit uneasy with the definition of space, but is saddle-shaped, which to me indicates that it has a limit. It has a boundary between the saddle and the imaginary non-existent horse under it. But that horse is nothing. Now, the saddle is expanding into nothing. has nothing a boundary. Okay, I but can you see my confusion?
I can. And yes, you know, okay. So in fact, the saddle is a two-dimensional analog of what we call openly curved space, right? So what we're trying to do when we put that saddle out there that looks like a Pringles potato chip is to try and give some sense of what curved space looks like. So the idea here, quite simply, space can be what we call flat, or it can be positively curved or negatively curved. This is very hard to imagine in three dimensions. So what we usually try and do is to describe it in two dimensions and then just say, okay, now use your brain and take that into the third dimension. So when we do it in two dimensions, it's quite easy. Flat just means, you know, what the sheet of paper looks like, and that's what we call Euclidean geometry. And the neat thing is that you probably think that that's all geometry is, because you're used to the angles of a triangle adding up to 180 degrees, and, you know, the circumference of a circle being 2 pi r and all of that sort of stuff. Now, unfortunately, Euclid did us a great disservice, because he stopped us thinking about other sorts of space. And we can, of course, have curved two-dimensional space. The surface of a ball is two-dimensional, okay, and it's positively curved. And if you go onto the surface of a sphere, then the angles of a triangle do not add up to 180 degrees. They're always more than 280 degrees. Sorry, 180 degrees. What am I talking about? They're always more than 180 degrees. You know, the circumference of a circle no longer is 2 pi r. It's less than 2 pi r, and so on. Now, negatively curved space is harder to imagine. The balls we're quite used to, but it's that saddle shape, okay? And so that's where the saddle bit comes in, okay? It's a two-dimensional analog of what might be three-dimensional space. But space is actually not negatively curved or positively curved. It is, in fact, flat, just to be unutterably perverse. So the flat bit works, okay? But, you know, until we knew about this dark energy stuff, which, you know, as I said, is very, very recent, we're really talking about the last 6 or 7 years, those other possibilities were still on the table. And now, I think, to a large part, they're off the table because we know it's flat. I hope that helped.
Thanks. Thank you. In approximately 4 billion years, the sun will become a red giant. Mm. But I've also read that within 1 billion years, or just after 1 billion years, our Earth will be uninhabitable because of the extreme heat. So what goes on between 1 billion years and 4 billion years when it becomes a red giant? Does it expand into a red giant quite slowly? Or?
Yeah, look, there is a process. The evolution of a star, you know, is obviously a continuous process. At you know, 4 billion years, you know, the actual outer layers of the sun will expand to you know, include the Earth. But before that, there's a gradual warming, okay? I think our understanding of the evolution of a star is not so precise that you'd want to put a time on it, but, you know, it will start to warm up a little beforehand. It's 1 billion years, though, so I wouldn't sweat too much. We've got some more immediate problems before then.
Thanks. Gentleman down here.
I wanted to ask a couple of questions about the structure of the universe. I hope they're not going to seem too naive. One is that if the universe started at a single point and then expanded, is all the matter distributed on the surface of a shape, or is it actually homogeneously distributed throughout there? And if it is the latter, how did the bits in the middle get there?
Okay. So this is one of those interesting things where you have to do some quite strong mental gymnastics, okay? So when we talk about first of all, the universe is largely homogeneous, except that, of course, it's not completely homogeneous. Obviously, we're in this room, and there's probably 30 orders of magnitude difference in the density in this room than there is on average in the universe, right? So this is not a typical place in the universe. Okay, but on average, if you go to a big enough volume, then the universe is sort of pretty uniform, okay? Now, then you have to start talking about exactly what the universe is. Now, where we sit today, there's something called the horizon, right? And the horizon, well, the horizon is simply the distance that we can see, over the full time that the universe has existed. So I just realised I should back up there just for a second. The universe, quote unquote, did have a beginning, right? And we actually know how old the universe is. It's about 1.3 billion years. Sorry, 13 billion years. 13.4 billion years or something. So there is a finite time associated with the universe. The speed of light has a finite velocity. So if you take a finite velocity, multiply by a finite time, you get a finite distance. And that's sort of that's the horizon. That's the distance that we can theoretically see in the universe today. Okay? But the really bizarre thing about our universe is that as time passes, obviously we can see further because the universe is older, right? And so we can see to a greater distance. And what we have discovered is that the new stuff that we can see is exactly sort of the same as the stuff that was already here. And yet, in very simple terms, there was no way that that stuff can have known that it should look like this stuff here, okay? Because, things have to talk to each other to be at the same temperature and to be at the same density. So how does that stuff that is coming within our horizon now know that it was supposed to have this temperature and this density, right? And so what that has led to are some very interesting ideas about how the very early universe might have evolved. So, for example, and these are ideas. I want to stress these are ideas. They're good ideas, but we don't have, it's very hard to test these ideas. We're talking about the universe when it was 10 to the minus 30 seconds old. So, something completely ridiculous to even start trying to think about. But in order to get this very strange consistency, we believe that the universe must have essentially inflated in a very, very rapid way, so that there was a very large volume, if you like, of our universe created at that time, which is slowly coming back within our horizon. Okay, and so that's the current explanation, and the way it's usually framed is as a very special sort of phase transition in the early universe that allowed this exponential growth, but I do want to stress that these are ideas, and it is actually quite hard to test these ideas in a very rigorous way. But what is absolutely true is that the stuff that's coming through knows what temperature it has to be at, and that's actually very important. Okay? Don't know if that helps.
Question over here.
You would have heard of this question before. What are the chances of SETI succeeding?
Well, are you familiar with Drake's equation? Okay. Well. So there's a very famous astronomer called Frank Drake who thought very hard about whether extraterrestrial life could exist out there. And he put the question on a firm mathematical basis. He said this is a question of probabilities. And so what we're going to do is we're going to construct a probability argument that says, how many stars are there in the universe? How many of those stars have got planets? How many of those planets could have life? How many of those will the life become intelligent? And, what's the probability that intelligent life will communicate? Okay. Now, in that sequence, the last factor in this probability sequence says, suppose that you have an intelligent communicating civilization, which is supposedly what we call ourselves, okay, then how long will this civilization live for? Because that will tell you in the end how many of such civilizations there are in the universe. Okay, so then this is then where it gets very interesting, because if to get to that stage you have to be very aggressive. And then, when you get to 100 years, which is... and I should say we've been intelligent and communicating in this sense since the Second World War. That was when radar was discovered was used. And so we've been intelligent and communicating for about, 60 years, 70 years, okay? So you could argue that if we get to 100 years and we blow ourselves up, because we're too aggressive, okay, then an intelligent communicating civilization only lives for 100 years. And if you do the sums and you put 100 years on it, then we're alone. And we're not. There's going to be nobody else out there. But if, we get our act together and somehow we manage to live with each other and continue to move forward and, you know, look after the planet and all the rest of it, and our civilization lives for, you know, 100,000 years, just say, or even longer, then there's going to be quite a lot of civilizations out there that have gone through the same process. And if there's a lot of them, then you can just do the probability arguments and you can figure out where the closest one is, and then you can work out, you know, what our chances are of actually talking to them by using speed of light arguments and so on. So that's basically the way to think about it.
Thanks.
Hey?
What's the answer? Somebody's asking you to give a definitive answer.
We're looking.
We don't know. We have no data to go on. Time's flying by, so we've got just time for one more question. Thank you.
When do you think humans will launch the first spacecraft to Mars and humans will set foot on the red planet?
Okay, that's a really good question. So we can already send people to Mars quite easily. Okay, technologically, that's not particularly difficult. It's actually not even particularly expensive necessarily. So, you know, we could afford to do this tomorrow if we decided to do it. And so all that it's going to take is somebody to make that decision. And then, of course, a couple of people to volunteer to go and do it. It may be a one-way trip, you know, because, you know, it's quite dangerous doing something like this and you can't always guarantee you're going to come back. But there's a society called the Mars Society, which I think you're quite involved with, who are preparing for the event, that eventuality. They've been running experiments where people have been living in the Australian desert and other inhospitable places in isolated circumstances to prepare them for the possibility of going and living on Mars. So you would have to create a closed dome or something to live in. But if there's water there, which we're almost certain there is now, then you could take your seeds along, grow your plants, generate oxygen and all the rest of it, and probably have quite a happy life all by yourself on the red planet.
Yes, so there's a group of NASA scientists right now up in the Flinders Ranges conducting a field trip along with some American teachers and 7 Australian teachers who I hope will be touring around and inspiring students. And if you're really interested, Mars Society Australia, look that up on the web, have got their annual conference here in Adelaide next weekend. If you're interested in astrophysics, please join the Astronomical Society of South Australia. It's the biggest and just about the most active. I shouldn't say the best. I'm sure Melbourne's got a good Astronomical Society.
It does.
But please look up the Astronomical Society of South Australia. They've got 400 or 500 members, very, very active, and you'll learn a lot from them. That goes for people of absolutely all ages. Bit of fascinating afternoon. Thank you very much for that, Rachel. Can we thank Rachel just one more time?
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.